time to tell me the truth, to burden your mouth for what you say, and pieces of paper in the way, 'cause I can't continue pretending to choose these opposite sides on which we fall, loving you later. You're listening to Between the Lines, a monthly magazine show on WGXC on the third Thursday of every month at 2 p.m. I'm your host, Anne Forbes Cooper, and my guests today are Christine Wade, a novelist who's written a book about based on a folk tale but set in the Catskill Mountains, and life coach and one of my favorite people, Janet Riccobono. So stay tuned.
No right minds could wrong be this many times. My memory is cruel, queen of attentions and details, defending intentions if he fails. Until now.
And I want to welcome
Janet Riccobono.
You are a life coach, which has become extremely popular in recent times. In fact, I read something about how it's almost $1 billion a year industry. What exactly is life coaching?
Life coaching is a process. It's a service industry where we help people who are looking to change. They're going through some sort of transformation, need resolve to a current situation. Life coaches are used for career transition. It is significantly different than counseling or therapy in that the emotional healing that's involved in therapy takes you back to where problems might have began and help you understand that. And coaching takes you forward. Coaching is about resolve. So it is a, I like the term, coaches are agents of change. So what we do is provoke thought, and it's a collaborative process where the client and the coach collectively define a situation and go about short-term process fixing it, so to speak.
So let's have a pretend session. Say I'm on the phone. I'm going, oh, Janet, you know, I'm in a, my radio career's going nowhere. I'm in a dead-end job at Bard. What can I do? I want to be a breakthrough novelist. What can I do? What sort of things would you ask me?
Well, I think the first thing, and you just you just said it in your you know, opening
Ramble.
There in your opening, yes. But I think one of the first things I would tend to ask is, what do you want? And then, what do you need? And what are you willing to do to get that? And what will happen if you don't do that? So those are things that we don't always think about. Well, you know, well, if I don't do that, then I won't have the book, and I won't have a legacy to leave, and I won't. So what are you willing to do to get
you
that?
Put your finger on a legacy to leave. Yeah.
Yes, yes.
And it's, I think that's right, actually. It's like, what am I willing to give up mm-hmm. to get what I want?
Right. And they seem very simple questions, and they are in theory, but it, you know, why is a very important question. And we make statements, well, why aren't you, maybe would be a better question. If you want to be a novelist, why aren't you now? And you give, well, because I have to pay the bills, and who's going to pay the bills? And so, you know, why, and tell me more, and why, and tell me more. And it may sound a little bit, you know, flighty and out there, but it when you really press somebody about the why, it uncovers a lot for them.
Yeah, so there really is a lot of psychology involved here. And it kind of is like therapy, even though you started off at the beginning by mm-hmm. saying it wasn't. But mm-hmm. Clearly, you have to be able to read people and just listen to what they're saying.
Mm-hmm.
And what made you get into life coaching?
Well, I was retiring from 30 years with Verizon and fortunate enough to be able to do that at 49. And I had been in customer service all my life. And so I think that probably they say do what you know when you want to do something. And I know people, and I build rapport fairly easily. So I started thinking, and it was a process of maybe a year or two before retirement. What am I going to do at 49 that will allow me to do what I know and learn and be challenged at the same time? So I had heard about this, and I had attended an Anthony Robbins seminar, and he's sort of the guru of life coaching. I was completely charged by that. So I went to school and certified.
So what exactly does that entail? What kind of school was it, and what did you have to
actually
go through?
It's an online school, it's all done, most coaching actually, even after you certify, is done over the telephone. And that's how my school was as well. In the class, there were 14 in my class from all over the country, and we'd meet once a week for 6 months. And it was fantastic because we got to feed off each other and learn from each other at the same time.
Now, do they accept anybody into this online course? I'm just curious. Or do you have to have some sort of a prerequisite background training in something else, or it's just...
No, there is an admissions process, and they do talk to you about your background and your desires and your future ideas and, you know, will this be a good fit for you? But most anybody, the people in the class ranged anywhere from highly educated lawyers and previous medical professionals to folks like myself who were looking for career transition, and moms, anybody, truly anybody. You have to be interested in people, you know, but you have to be interested in human behavior and understand that no matter how like or similar we're raised, or the environment that we live in, or the professions we've chosen, we're all incredibly different, and we absorb things differently, and we react to things differently. And that has been, as much as I thought I might know people, been probably the most rewarding, because you don't know what to expect.
How do you get your clients? Message out there?
I actually find that difficult because you do have to sell yourself to a degree. And being fairly new at this, I still find that a bit of a challenge. But it's mostly recommended that you find a niche so that you're not way out there as an all over. It's sort of like a doctor being general medicine. It's you know, you specialize. So I've taken on midlife women going through transition, and I call my business New Life at Midlife. And so it's basically women 40 to 50 and up are who I target. It's a popular age group because women are somewhat settled in their ways and want to change. And we have this fantastic opportunity, this generation does, to have people out there, to have a network. Our moms didn't have that. They went through empty nest and they went through retirement. And each time something like that happened in their life, it wasn't a celebration. It was closing of a door. Children left. That's done. Career has ended. That's done. And it's not a loss. It's a brand new beginning.
Yeah. Do you think that more women are attracted to this kind of therapy anyway, in as much as it seems to me there's more women that go into psychoanalysis or go into therapy?
I don't think women are as, well, this might be too general a statement, but I don't know that women are as frightened to understand themselves and move forward.
I like that, frightened to understand themselves.
So they want it figured out, you know, and also women don't mind spending money on themselves. So when it comes to the value of taking care of yourself and reaching out for a little help in that area, it's not so troublesome.
When you first heard about life coaching, What did you think about it?
Well, there's, you know, there's been transformational processes since I think about the 70s or so, when Werner Erhard started EST training and that kind of stuff.
That is what it's kind of been compared to.
Yeah, yeah. And that is, from what I understand, I've never been through an EST seminar, but it's quite, you purge completely and then, you know, you rebuild. So it's a true transformation. The life coaching industry sort of more jumped into the late 80s and to mid 90s was its beginning. You know, I think it was exciting to hear about it. I human behavior has always been something that if I thought I would go back to school, it would probably be something that I'd do. And it was challenging. And then to put the word coaching on it made it feel invigorating, sort of enthusiastic, because I think we all associate coaching right away with sports. And so I had this visual of, you know, you can do it kind of thing. That must be what it's about. Mm-hmm. And it pretty much is. That's really oversimplistic, but it is.
In your own life, I understand that you had a life-changing event happen.
Mm-hmm. In, you mean medically?
Yes.
Yes. In November of 2011, I had a heart attack. And that was extremely life-changing for all of us, for my children and my husband as well. We were having lunch here at home, and I had had, other than some weight gain since retirement, because we play and we socialize and we have fun, I was pretty fit. And I noticed for about a week prior to the heart attack that I was getting more tired easily, climbing stairs, little exhaustion.
But you had no history of
no, there
problems.
Is family history, but I'd had no history. Mm-hmm. And we had lunch, and I felt like I got indigestion, and I after a couple of minutes, I knew it was more than that, but I didn't know. And my husband called 911 anyway, and they bring a portable machine with them, and they knew right away it was my heart. And then in the ambulance, I arrested, and they had to resuscitate. So it was it was, and that was, I was 51, so...
Oh my God.
Yeah, my grandfather, as it turns out, I didn't ever know my grandfather, but he had died at 51 with a heart attack, and his father before him, although I don't know how old. So I think I kind of, you know, made a general assumption that it would be the men in the family, but there it is.
You say it almost sort of, you're saying it, you're describing it with a smile on your face, mm. But it must have been the most terrifying thing that had ever happened to you.
It is... I say it with a smile on my face because it's the incident of life that I get to somehow share with people over and over because people find it very interesting. So it's funny that you comment on the smile, because I've been asked before, gee, you seem to have bounced back so quickly. And I think just that I lived is exhilarating. And, you know, you get a second chance. So I don't dwell so much on the incident itself, but more how I got there. And I had been told for a couple of years by my doctor that my cholesterol was going up as I put on weight, and to take it off. And oh, yeah, yeah, yeah. And if you don't, I'm going to put you on medicine. And oh, I don't want medicine. Well, then take off weight. And it was this 2-year process. And so now, lo and behold, I'm on cholesterol meds, and that's what it was. I was fortunate enough to not have to have surgery. They did a catheterization in the hospital as soon as I, you know, arrived, and they saw the blockage and were prepping me for surgery, and the clot cleared itself, flushed out of my artery, and they felt my heart was strong, and they didn't do any surgery. So in that way, I was blessed, and so I work much more diligently at taking care of myself and knowing that I am, you know, here for a short time. So take care of myself. I can't say that I am fanatical in any way. I love to eat. I love to cook. We love to go out. So those things exist in my life, and there are things you can't avoid, but I don't eat the way I did, and I don't cook the way I did, and I don't drink the way I did, you know, so those things are all important. And I exercise more, and I fit the good things into my life, and then I get the rewards. It's not life is not just one big reward every day.
Well, I have to say you look fantastic, but then I always thought you looked fantastic.
Thank you, Anne.
You look even more fantastic now.
Thank you, Anne.
How did that change your perspective on life, or also on what you do on life coaching?
I can say that one of the biggest things that changed for me in changing my perspective, when you're in the hospital and you've had something like that happen, and my daughter is in South Carolina and my son is in California, so neither were here for the incident, and to hear their voices and know the impact that that had on them, it was a real slap in the face that we coexist and we mean something to other people, and in a way that we don't always think about. And to have had the possibility of my life being shortened and not being around for them, it's life-changing is an understatement. But it gives you great perspective, and professionally it did the same. It jump-started my feelings of, you know, there's so many people that go through so many things, and you look at them and you know we walk by each other on the street, or we work with people, and we rarely know them as intimately as we only know them as much as they allow us to know them. Everybody has a disability, and everybody hurts, and everybody has challenges. Yeah. And so it was extremely helpful, because you'd look at me and not have any clue that I have heart disease. You know, it's eye-opening.
And when you have clients, do you share this kind of thing with them? Does it come up? If perhaps they've gone through something similar?
Or... Mm-hmm. In coaching, truly in a session, the client does a lot more talking than the coach. Coach's responsibility is to provoke thought and to ask a lot of questions and get to the bottom of things, because there's so many layers generally before we admit to truths. And the job of a coach is to uncover a lot of those layers that you didn't even know existed. Yeah, absolutely. I've always been an open book anyway, so I share my life pretty easily. But yeah, anything that will help, you know.
you're just joining us, you're listening to Between the Lines, and I'm your host, Anne Forbes Cooper, and I'm here talking to Janet Riccobono, life coach.
And why do you think it is so popular these days?
That's a good question. I just think perhaps that, and I'm sure there's a lot of answers to that question, but I think perhaps awareness. We look at where we're going, and there's no one single path anymore. Generations before us, their life was more written out for them. We have options. We can begin at 50 or 40.
Yeah, I think also today we're almost expected to have 2, 3, 4 different kinds of careers. So why not get a bit of advice as to how to, you know, pursue these careers?
Well, I think that's an important thing you just said, is we are expected, period, to do a lot. To do a lot, you know, especially women, forgive me for saying so, but women are expected to run the household and work, and many of those traditional old-fashioned standards have not changed, and we take it on because being career women is an extra. It's in addition to everything else that we've always been taught we should do, and it's DNA. I mean, we're hardwired to take care of our families and our home, so we do that, and then we, you know, school ourselves and take on jobs. And multitasking is not that easy, nor, and I just read this somewhere, do we do anything effectively and as efficiently and with quality as we could or should if we slowed down a little bit and took our time. But we do. And that's maybe another layer of coaching.
What have you learned through doing this, making this, having these dramatic changes in your life over the past?
Well, something every day. I have tweaked a lot of my own personality. I've become more tolerant and more patient, certainly more loving, more grateful for everything that I have. And I think that, you know, helping people, being in any kind of service industry, and seeing somebody sort of virtually, because we're on the phone, their voice lighten, or that aha moment that they can have, or, wow, I never thought of that. It's nice to be part of that transformation.
Do you find that you have to explain what you do to people? Have people actually heard of it?
I explain it a lot.
And what do they say? What's their reactions when they hear?
Well, quite honestly, when you say you're a life coach, they say, oh, and that's it.
Oh.
It's because most people don't know, and because, I don't know about most people, but because people don't know, and it's newer, you know, they don't know what so much to ask and what it really means. Many coaches, certainly myself, which is why I bring it up, hire coaches. So we understand the process
that's what they do in therapy too. If you're a therapist, you have to have psychoanalysis.
Yeah. So it's been very interesting. And I actually did weight loss coaching. And I then, once I wanted to get things off the ground, I started my business. I went and got a DBA and I named myself, my website, janetriccobono.com. So that's not hard. But, you know, and I got that started, but I really was going nowhere quick because I didn't quite know how to grab it and run with it. And so I hired a business coach, and that was fantastic. That phase of life, that second half, that act two, so to speak, for women 40 and up who have a now what kind of question hanging over their head, those are the women I help. Those are the women that I coach. So that makes it a little more, oh, you know, I have a friend. And that's kind of how the conversation then begins to roll. Or, oh, what about me, you know? So it just, because I do like to think of coaches, certainly myself, as agents of change and those who provoke thought. And that gets them to that place a little more quickly than just, I'm a life coach.
You can also travel with it. I mean, you don't really have to be. There's no reason to be in Catskill.
No, so exactly.
Lovely, so Catskill is. Yeah. And speaking of life coaches, I think Catskill needs a bit of life coaching. You know?
I think Catskill needs a bit of life advice, coaching.
Even though it's not a 40 to 50-year-old woman, but, you know, it's like, needs all the help it can get.
It
Catskill.
Is a little stuck, though, don't you think?
Yes. Okay, and on that note, I'd like to thank you very much for being on Between the Lines. Janet Riccobono, life coach.
Again, I do have a website, which is janetriccobono.com, and that's RICCOBONO. Couldn't be easier. Really?
Riccobono. Really? Riccobono.
Riccobono. Thank you, Han. Thanks very much for having me.
She's just a girl and she's on fire. Fire. Hotter than a fantasy. Only like a highway. She's living in a world and it's on fire. Catastrophe, but she knows she can fly away. Oh, she got both feet on the ground and she's burning it down. Oh, she got her head in the clouds and she's not backing down. This girl is on fire.
Listening to Between the Lines. I'm your host, Anne Forbes Cooper, and my next guest is Christine Wade, novelist.
Christine Wade is a researcher and writer who fell in love with the Hudson River when she first attended Bard College, and she's lived on its shores in New York City and the Catskill Mountains ever since. Seven Locks, her first novel, which came out in January, won a James Jones Fellowship Award for an unpublished novel in 2009. Published by Simon & Schuster, Seven Locks begins in 1769, and it spans the years of the American Revolution. Heavily influenced by American folklore, It tells the tale of a drunken, somewhat feckless man who mysteriously disappears without a trace, abandoning his wife and children on their farm at the foot of the Catskill Mountains. Reviewers have described it as a beautifully written tale that lives somewhere between landscape and memory, where regret becomes a prison and a story told often enough becomes truth. Christine, welcome to Between the Lines. And you're going to read us an excerpt from the book?
The story is told in two voices, a mother and her daughter. And I will introduce you to the main narrator, the mother. She's an odd duck. She is not well-liked in her village. She has a sharp tongue. Yet she loves her children, and she enjoys her work, and she likes to read and is self-aware and has a sense of humor. But she doesn't get along with her neighbors. So when her husband goes missing, it poses a serious problem for her. I'm going to read you a passage where she's just discovering that he might not just be out for the night, but he may have disappeared beyond the boundaries of her world. Our village, an hour's walk on a winding track, was not unlike any other along Hudson's River. The hamlet had come to be more than 100 years ago as a settlement of trappers' huts amid the kills and falls that ran down from the mountains. Evidently a Dutchman, small in stature but large in reputation, and known only by the double diminutive of Klein Sagerty or Little Sawyer, had once built a mill here, perhaps providing boards and beams to erect the grand estate houses across the river. So the place of our little bracket of a dozen houses was sometimes called the Sager's Kiltje. Now, with its stone houses, it was steeped in its own traditions. We celebrated Kerstad, Nooijaar, Pas, and Pinkster. In the large town of Kingston to the south, with carpenters, blacksmiths, masons, tailors, weavers, shoemakers, brickmakers, sloop builders, sailmakers, and tanners. But in our little neck of the woods, almost all the families did a little of everything and took up what, in the case of my husband, is ironically called husbandry, that is, extracting from the land, and not without considerable effort, sustenance, and larder. I did not wish to walk down to the village with my shame-filled eyes. I forced myself, leaving the children alone at the farm. I decided to visit Nicholas Vader purposefully and in the morning in order to avoid the tavern crowd, which gathered just prior to the afternoon meal. He was my choice over our parish dominie, who might serve me a sermon, and besides, who was here only on Sundays when his services were required, while a brewmaster did daily service in even a village as small as ours. I considered that the tavern keeper would have the ear of the men, while a churchman would have the ear of the women. And it was true that if you gained the women's sympathy, the men would follow. But I took my chances with the men, because I thought the women's kindness might be out of my reach. I did not want their pity, and I could not think how to approach them. I seemed to have had the double misfortune of not gaining the hearts and minds of other women, and the men had me pegged as the embodiment of all that they could suffer from their wives. By that I mean that the men could chastise me instead of the wife on whom they depended, and thereby a man could mark for her the boundary over which she must not cross. Our village was one street with a dozen or more freestanding stone houses lined up neat as a pin and much alike in size and shape, with a stone church at one end and a crossroad, the King's Highway, at the other. Don't let the word highway with the king's title before it fool you. The highway was a mud track, much like the one that led to our farm, and not a penny of it was paid for by the king. The sloops on the river, with their wide planks and high quarter decks, were the most reliable means of transportation. The roads between towns were but rocky ditches, and cargoes were hardly ever transported along them. A well-made Dutch sloop had a high forward mast and lovely sheets, and could carry upward of 100 tons upon her decks. And this is how our goods came to us. when the river wasn't iced over. In those winter months, we had no goods at all. The tavern was at the turning from the village street north onto the highway. I kept my eyes low and hurried past the houses. Much to my chagrin, Mr. Vader was not yet up, and I found myself waiting on the bench beneath the grim portrait of George III. I had brought edging and worked my needle up close to my face so that while I nodded at any passerby, I quickly returned to my task, which kept them on their path of the morning's errands. Finally, when the sun was hot, I heard the tread on the stairs and the inmate scurrying to bring the keeper his mead or cider and his mild cough when she told him that I was waiting to speak to him. Still I waited, and when he finally emerged through the inn's door, he was tamping down his pipe. I was too tentative to express any annoyance by the wait, but he responded to expected annoyance in me by being deliberately slow. After greeting me, he fumbled in his pocket for a flint to light it, as yet not ready to begin our conversation. Eventually, he asked about my family, and while I could not meet his eyes, for we were not exactly friends, I said outright that I had come to speak to him as to the whereabouts of my husband, which were unknown to me these past 2 days. Best to spill the flour on the table if one wants to bake a pie. He raised his eyebrows, gazed down his nose, drawing on the tobacco, and held the smoke in a bit. He was an ugly man with inflated pores and a sallow skin and patchy whiskers. But a man's appearance does not diminish his self-importance. If you ask me, he looked both brazen-faced and sick. Mr. Vader had not seen my husband since the day before yesterday, when he indeed had stopped on the benches in the tavern yard. Drawing on his pipe, he reflected. Yes, yesterday, come to think of it, his absence had been remarked. But this is not so unusual. The good Mr. Vader ventured, seemingly without irony, that he had thought he might have spent the day working his farm. But I did not miss the tone of his speaking and what was not said. Had my husband mentioned any pending journey? I asked the tavern keeper. I felt myself redden, as the question itself admitted the condition of my marriage. No, he had not. I then told of how he had not returned to his bed 2 nights prior, after having set out in the afternoon through the woods alone with his dog. Mr. Vader relit his pipe and then offered what little there was in assurance. Your husband may have wandered too far in his search for game, and losing his way, ended in another village, and stopped and visited a while, and surely will arrive, footsore and primed with some new stories, sometime today. Water will come to the ditch. I nodded at this point of view, giving the impression that I believed it, and that I was consoled by him, even as the poverty of his assurance annoyed me. What kind of man could not find his way to his own farm? I knew not whether I was irked by such a man or by Mr. Vader, who spoke as if such occurrences were ordinary, thereby suggesting that my concerns were not. I asked if he could kindly notify the other villagers as they arrived to his benches about my situation, in case anyone might know of my husband's whereabouts. If there were any news, would you kindly send someone out to my farm or tell my neighbors, who would surely come to me? Curtsying, I could not get away soon enough.
Uh-huh. Thank you very much for that. I have to say I enjoyed reading this very much. What I particularly liked about the book is that it's a deeply layered book. You've got a terrific sense of the lyricism, use very evocative language, and you also have created a very strong character who's complex. She's not entirely sympathetic. Was that ever difficult for you? Was that ever an issue, creating a character who you knew might not be liked by the reader particularly?
Well, that was one of the layers. I wanted to unpack the stereotype of the scold and make it a little more dimensional and real. And I wanted a mixed character, one that you might question, but I think is sympathetic in the end. And I happen to enjoy her quite a bit. I know that some people, not everyone will enjoy her, But I enjoyed her sense of humor, her sharp tongue, her musings on her challenges, which are sometimes a little almost sarcastic.
I think that you're right. What I started off not liking her, and then I ended up admiring her because she has such depth, because she actually seemed real instead of a one-dimensional caricature.
I wanted the landscape to be romantic, mm-hmm. but not the character.
So now, what inspired you to write this book? I mentioned sort of earlier it's very heavily influenced by American folk tales. What drew you to this kind of subject matter?
I love the area. I've had a house at the top of Flat Cove, which is the southernmost canyon of the eastern Catskills, and that's where the Catskills butt up against the river plain, and it's a very magical area. And I really didn't have an idea to write this novel. I didn't ponder it or contemplate it. It just occurred to me one day, and I thought, well, this is kind of an interesting idea. Why don't I try it? And as soon as I started having a really good time, and the writing came really fast. But what really inspired me was reading other books. I had just read Shakespeare's Wife by Germaine Greer, which is a wonderful nonfiction book. Germaine Greer, which you may remember from the 1970s, a feminist.
Absolutely.
Is also an Elizabethan scholar, and she took on and writes an imaginative portrait of Anne Hathaway, Shakespeare's wife. And I learned from that that all the Shakespearean scholars had dismissed Anne Hathaway as an unimportant person who could not possibly have influenced Will, her husband, who perhaps seduced him and had a shotgun marriage, and he left her. They lived separately. But Germaine Greer contextualizes this so that we get a much different portrait of a marriage than these scholars who had just said, he never could have written the sonnets to her. And this annoyed me a lot. And I was a little bit annoyed at Washington Irving, who was reading also the sketchbook of Geoffrey Guyon, who can dismiss a famous man's wife, in a word, as a scold. I love the local history of the area, and it all sort of converge. I had read An Island in the Center of the World, another wonderful nonfiction book about the Dutch colony. And although that was set, that history is of 100 years earlier than the time that I chose to write about, I found it really intriguing and informative.
Across the evening sky, all the birds are leaving. Oh, but then you know it was time. Time.
And if you've just joined us, you're listening to Between the Lines. I'm your host, Anne Forbes Cooper, and my guest today is Christine Wade, the author of a new novel called Seven Locks, set in the Catskill Mountains.
And you go into tremendous detail about the food and the customs and what the landscape was like. Did you do an enormous amount of research?
Well, I feel like I had been doing it all along before I had the idea of the book. I like to read widely. So while I did have to search out things I was looking for, like the food, I thought that writing about the food was very anchoring. I mean, it's really what we do every day, and I have a passion for food, and it's very important. And of course, her whole life was preparing food. That was mostly what she did. So it was interesting to learn about the colonial foodstuffs, what was available, what wasn't.
And the way that you describe a lot of the subject matter, too, is very, very lyrical, but it is told in a voice that's very sort of archaic in a way and very arcane. It's not, it almost sounds reads sort of unnaturally to us now in the 21st century. Was that hard to achieve?
It came sort of naturally to me. I'm a German speaker. I have a sense of that, like a different grammar. I was writing in English, of course, but it's the voice of somebody whose main language is Dutch. And so I just kind of imagined her voice came sort of naturally to me. It's not the voices that you find in 18th century novels. I read another book at the time, which also very much inspired this one. It's called The Bitch in the House, and it's a collection of essays by Vivian Gornick and various other women writers about how they deal with the politics of home and work and children. So I realized that my themes still had a modern relevance.
And it is essentially a folk tale. What is the relevance of folk tales to us today? What can we learn from them?
Well, I don't want to really reveal the folktale that it's based on, but it's based on a famous folktale, and most people will recognize it. And it brings in sort of the dream layer and the symbolic layer of what her life is and how her children will move forward, being lost in the forest. It has a lot of folktale elements. The journey, getting home from the journey. I've always admired authors who go a little bit toward the surreal, but then come back from it a little bit.
And another one of the layers, actually, is the structure, because you go back and forth. It's mainly told in the main protagonist, who does not have a name, but then it jumps to her daughter, who does have a name, who's called Judith. What was the thinking behind that?
As I said, I wanted the main character to be every woman. And I felt that Judith, whose perspective the reader first gains when she's a child of eight, and Judith's voice grows, and it is at the end of the book, the last section of the book, it is entirely Judith's perspective, looking back to her life as a child. She understood that she had so many more opportunities than her own mother had, and that her mother's life was really hard.
Why is it called Seven Locks?
I started looking at Dutch proverbs, and I like them very much. There are many Dutch proverbs that are the same in English. I mean, when you translate them, better late than never, or speak of the devil. And
those are
we all
Dutch.
Know what these proverbs mean, because not because we literally understand, because they say something that's literal, repeated over and over and over again in a very particular context, that we know exactly what they mean when you say speak of the devil. But there are certain proverbs that don't across cultures. And so when you translate them, they are very culturally specific, and you may not know exactly what they mean. Think of perhaps what you've heard of a Chinese proverb. It sounds mysterious and interesting, and you sort of have a feeling that because people have said this for many, many years, that you have to probe its meaning or you have to assimilate its meaning. And I felt that way about the proverb, "The future is a book with seven locks." So that's where the title comes from. It comes from that proverb. And I like that proverb because it references time by saying the future is a book. I wanted time to, and lost time and memory seemed to be a lot of what I was writing about. It also sort of says life is unpredictable and we have to figure it out as we go along. We have to unlock the pages so we can see what happens in our life. And I love the images of locks and keys, and the 18th century technology of locks and keys is really very beautiful.
How long did you take to write this book?
It came very quickly. I wrote the first draft in about 8 months. For half of that time, I was working full-time. So 3 months into that, I suddenly got this idea. And I started writing feverishly, and it's a pleasure for me. And I feel really lucky that I had time to start this book.
You make it sound so easy, whereas most writers, you know, they refer to it as sitting over the, well, we don't use typewriters anymore, but sitting over the typewriters and you slit your wrist and just let the blood pour onto the typewriter.
I just want to thank, you know, I'm just so grateful. There are so many people who helped me, but I want to give just one nod to all the women and people of color who experienced the American Revolution and men without property as well, and who didn't gain their rights. And I think that's a very interesting aspect of American history and American symbolism.
Because, of course, that is part of your book towards the end. The latter part of it involves the plight of two freed slaves, essentially, or freemen.
Yes, I wanted to link that to her personal freedom. I mean, they gained the freedom from bondage. Yes, I thank you for touching on many of the layers of the book, because I did try to write a layered book.
And where can listeners get hold of the novel?
I would encourage readers to go to their local bookstore, because they all need our support, and it's wonderful to have them. And in the Mid-Hudson River Valley, we have so many great ones.
And what is the address of your website?
www.christinewadebooks.com.
And do you have any readings coming up?
I do. I'll be reading at the Catskill Mountain Foundation with two other authors in March. I'm also participating in an event at the Millbrook Winery that has an event for authors, and that's in the fall.
Once again, thanks so much for being on Between the Lines.
Thank you, Anne.
The music you've been listening to is Sarah Bareilles's Between the Lines, Sheryl Crow's Change Would Do You Good, Alicia Keys' This Girl's on Fire, and Eva Cassidy with Who Knows Where the Time Goes. You've been listening to Between the Lines, and I'm your host, Anne Forbes Cooper. Thanks, as always, for listening.